The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with John Gilroy of Lectromech, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of Lectromech, providing solutions to design, certify, and maintain aircraft wire systems. Every week, John speaks with public and private sector IT experts about some of the IT trends and challenges facing agencies and industry. Now your host, John Gilroy.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio today, we have a couple cybersecurity experts who focus on cryptography, and I thought I'd bring them in order to open up the world of cryptography to my federal people. You know, they want to know constantly what's going on in the real world, what's going on in the commercial world, and what kind of benchmarks, how they can compare themselves with the commercial world. And I thought we'd bring in a couple folks here who are well-known in the Washington, D.C. area and soon to be well-known in the country, and to have them talk about cryptography and some of the strengths and weaknesses of maybe some approaches we talked about on the air here recently. In the studio, we have Michael Wellman. He's the CEO and founder. And we have Dimitri Dane. He's the CTO and founder of a company called Virgil Security. Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for having us on the show.
Great. Thank you, John.
Great. By the way, Truth in Advertising, I invited these two characters into my classroom, and they had 19 graduate students there, and they were spellbound. It was an hour, and I thought it was 10 minutes. It was a great presentation, and I just really appreciate you coming to my classroom, and I thought it'd be good to share it to a wider audience than but just 19 graduate students at Georgetown University. And this will talk about that, because a lot of I think what you did is you did a lot of what they talk about in the Byzantine Empire is iconoclasm and breaking icons. And that's what you guys do, is break some icons. But before we begin, Michael, tell us a little about your background and all your fancy degrees and titles and awards. That take about a half hour, I think, huh?
I don't have a lot of fancy degrees.
Yes, you do.
I have a small collection of degrees, primarily from Rice University. My focus was in electrical engineering, computer science, and mathematical and applied math. So in terms of the professional background, for most of the last 30 years, I started off building what we at the time called connected devices, now what people call IoT. Kind of the highlight of that run was being on the team that shipped the first couple of generations of Apple's AirPort products and doing a couple of DARPA projects around mobile ad hoc networking and secure communications.
I also went to your LinkedIn profile. I saw something about history and something about the viola. This is quite a background you have here, huh? And your picture is some guy in a river somewhere. I mean, so you got a wide background.
I think I actually have a quote on there from Heinlein that says, you know, the best specialty is to be a generalist.
There's no specialty for you, huh? Well, that's good. And so you have over 25 years experience in cryptography in many different areas, including this hard-to-define topic of IoT.
That's correct.
Good, great. And Dimitri, about your background, please.
Well, I'm sort of the polar opposite of Michael.
It's perfect, yin and yang.
Yeah, Michael hired me when I was 18 years old, straight out of high school, to work on the product you just mentioned, Apple AirPort, and it's been fun building products together ever since.
And that's very humble about Michael. I mean, he's working on AirPort. I mean, this is kind of a big deal, okay? But I'll let you go on, Dimitri.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a huge deal. It was the first Wi-Fi.
I know it was. It was a big deal.
Yeah, I remember talking to my parents at the time and telling them I'm working on something that will be in everyone's pocket and everyone's home, and they looked at me crazy. And then this is circa 1999-2000, and of course no Wi-Fi, no internet in a lot of places. A lot of people didn't even know what that was. So that was a lot of fun. That was one of the.
So Michael, you brought in the little puppy Dimitri and gave him a shot, huh? Wow.
Yeah. If you had a much longer show, we could, you know, share the joys of getting an 18-year-old hired at Lucent. But,
so what happened from there? Must have done something right, huh, Dimitri? What happened from there?
Well, we did 4 years together there. And after that, I worked on a DARPA program called DARPA XG, Cognitive Radios in Manes. And that was a lot of fun as well. We took that from to a deployed program. So that was exciting as well in its own way, certainly for somebody who was 23, 24-year-old at the time.
I actually joined Dimitri on that project. What he didn't mention is what made it really fun was beating people like Raytheon, SAIC, and Rockwell, as, you know, we were like a 12-person shop who, you know, won a phase 3 program over those guys.
Wow. And the big difference between me and Dimitri is on my side of the table, I got 0, and his side of the table, he's got 7 patents. That's pretty remarkable, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. Well, it wasn't just me. It was a great team here in Virginia, Northern Virginia. But
you got your name on the piece of paper. I would claim it. So seven patents. Wow, that's fascinating. So you really are kind of grassroots from the ground up, learning it out in the street.
That was always my approach. My dad's a ham radio operator. I kind of learned together with him when I was young. So I kind of learned to kind of do things on my own and figure out things on my own. And sort of back when I was doing that in the Soviet Union, where I was born, certainly no books, no internet, and you kind of just figure it out on your own, especially when you're a ham radio operator, which is kind of a sensitive area in and of itself.
Yeah, that's really true. So, Michael, my wife's a Latin teacher, so I get to ask this question. Virgil, oh, she likes that name a lot. Whoa, that's a good name. So how did you come up with the name, and what does Virgil Security do?
So, you know, our official cover story for Virgil
Security. Official, yes.
There's always how you got there, and then there's the story you build around it. You know, when you get into Dante's Infernal, Virgil was Dante's guide through the seven layers of hell. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever tried to build security and cryptography into a product, it's very similar. But, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of the time it comes down to you try to find a name that's relevant to what you're doing. And Virgil was an interesting combination of virtual and Virginia and one other that is now slipping my mind.
Security, maybe.
But so, you know, it the fact we could build a story around it and that there was no competitors for the name Virgil Security except for a security guard company in Virgil, Kansas, meant that, you know, you could do good search engine optimization around it as well.
So the real answer is SEO. So if you're picking a name there and you got to pick something where you can you control the brand. So
yeah,
that's why you see the branding the way it is today.
But we like the guiding story.
Now, you're very active on Twitter. I'm on Twitter all the time, too. Hashtag secure the future. Hashtag no more passwords. Hashtag encrypt everything. That's the motto there, huh?
Yes.
Wow. So if you want to go on Twitter, you can follow them and all kinds of adventures and things going on and presentations and here and there. And poor Dimitri getting dragged here and there across the country and giving presentations. And you can go to YouTube and look up a presentation by Dimitri as well. So I'll ask you the question that I ask many people. And the question is, okay, Virgil Security, that's good. So what business problem do you guys solve?
So the short version is, you know, as you're looking to the future of any device or product that's connected to the internet, it needs to be more secure, but security has always been very difficult. So we wanted to give people who are building products building blocks so they can build security into their products without having to become a security expert themselves. And so that gives them some things like authentication without passwords, so you can log in just using a device, so you can have a device in your house connecting back to a server without having to have a password embedded that gets stolen by hackers. That gives them things like encrypting all of their data either in transit or at rest, and that gives them the ability to do cryptographic verification to ensure that the data is unchanged, that the data is who from it says it is. And that becomes more and more important as we move into the Internet of Things and more connected devices.
So your typical customer may not be Joe Sixpack. It may not be a project manager at an agency, but it may be a software developer working for a company that contracts with the federal government. That could be one of your customers, huh?
It could. We actually do see a lot of product managers driving customers to us because they know they need some of that functionality, but they also know they don't have the experience on the team to build it themselves. So product managers are one of our entry points.
So Dimitri, no more passwords? Is that smart? I mean, everyone needs a password, don't they?
Absolutely. We certainly need to change the way we use passwords, and that's one of the key things. There are about 20 million software developers around the world, and we want to give them the ability to deploy cryptography without knowing anything about them. So we want to end the days where you need it for your college degree just to be able to do basic things like public-private key infrastructure. And that's the business problem we're trying to solve. Give those people the ability that are building products that are being purchased by the federal government. When they're coming into the federal government, they need to have these protections. They need to have this functionality built into them. And that's the software developers that are frankly all over the world.
We talk about many things on the air here. I always look at my 506 shows, and believe it or not, I look for keywords because I'm a keyword type of guy, and phrases, and what has recently popped up in probably the last 5 or 6 years is the word insider threat. And if you can graph that, it's like a Google Trends. I imagine if you went to Google Trends and graphed Insider Threat, you'd see it go up, and the same thing with my show here. What I'd like to do is maybe take a break, come back. We'll talk about insider threats, talk about cryptography, and this whole concept of no more passwords. I mean, I have some spreadsheet with 120 usernames and passwords on. I'm supposed to change those every 90 days, every 30 days. I mean, you know, I mean, you can spend half my life just memorizing passwords. So let's take a break, come back, talk more about cryptography and maybe the fancy pants public key cryptography, which is hard for some people to understand. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, Michael Wellman and Dimitri Dane, and they're the founders of a company called Virgil Security. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, we have Michael Wellman and Dimitri Dane. They are the founders of a company called Virgil, V-I-R-G-I-L Security. And just type that in your little browser. You wind up their site. Got all kinds of interesting information there. Now, I'm doing my research for this show, Michael. I went to your LinkedIn profile. I went down to the awards section, and I think you kind of ran out of ink putting awards down. Did you make up some of these awards? I mean, is every award possible? You got tons and tons of awards, don't you?
No, we didn't have to make them up yet.
soon. Best looking in Fairfax County.
Yeah, if we get to the best looking for CEO, you'll know it's made up. but, you know, what we found is, you know, when you get into cybersecurity, and we don't even consider ourselves a cybersecurity company, we consider ourselves a developer-centric company. But when you get into cybersecurity right now, all you see in the media and all you see in the press is fear and people constantly trying to sell fear. And nobody really buys into fear except as a thing they have to do. So we instead present to people solutions to the things that they're afraid of. You know, when you look around and you see that 95% of breaches in cybersecurity oftentimes start with passwords, one of the first things we're telling people is we can help you get rid of passwords. You know, we can help you move to a future where, you know, the primary vector into your company is no longer a viable vector. And then when you move to like that next step and you know, encryption means once you're inside someone's network, it's a lot harder for them to get value by stealing your data. The data is already encrypted. They also have to get the data decrypted. And even when you move into the cryptographic verification, it's the same kind of thing. Right now, people can push malware to devices on the edge of your network, at your house, at your home, in your business. And if you make them sign their firmware so that it only runs valid firmware, you're again giving them a solution. So when we see things like these botnets that are doing distributed denial of service attacks, we don't sell the fear of that. We sell a solution to that. And that story resonates well with people.
So, Dimitri, tell me your side of the story. So how come you guys get so many awards here? So many competition out there. You're getting all kinds of awards.
Look, I mean, a part of it is the empowerment story that Michael just said. Certainly, we make software developers look good. We make them smarter by extension of your technology. But certainly, working the refs is how you win in the startup circle, right? So we had to go do a lot of events. And the list of the ones we didn't win and we didn't do well in is much longer than the one
So you have 100 awards and 900 you didn't get.
That's right. There is certainly a brute force approach to it, right? And it worked for us. It certainly worked for us. We're in DC area, so raising money is much harder. So you have to go get more social credibility than probably you otherwise would have if you were based in the Valley or in the New York areas, but we've done well, and it's an empowerment story, working the refs, and certainly going to a lot of events and kind of publicizing what we're doing.
Michael, I was at the Salesforce conference maybe a month ago, and they use this word artificial intelligence, and I said, everyone does artificial intelligence, it's applying to everything. However, artificial intelligence really fits into the world of cryptography, doesn't it? I mean, this is a good fit.
So it is. And, you know, when you get into artificial intelligence, if you've been in the industry for a while, and I'm, you know, 30 some odd years of doing things professionally, you will have seen artificial intelligence as a cycle. I think we're on our fourth or fifth time. But what we're running into now is more machine learning and big data analysis as a manifestation of artificial intelligence. And when you get into that machine learning, you have data coming in from all over the planet, and you have to make sure that it's actually your data, that, you know, your competitors or some bad actors are not injecting data into your system. And so that cryptographic verification for artificial intelligence is going to be a key factor going forward.
So, Dimitri, what people talk about is verification of data, devices, and identities. All three accomplished through encryption?
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to start it from the device, from the sensor, from that's generating the data, and then you go up the stack. Well, the way you transport the data has to be secured. The way you store the data has to be secured. And then as you get the machine learning algorithms going, you need to understand the provenance of that data, where it came from, especially if you are trying to make some control decisions over the top of that data. So previously we simply consumed information. Now we are making decisions in an automated fashion. So now you need to understand why you're making that decision, and you need to record probably in almost a blockchain style storage mechanism where every decision tree is forever written and it cannot be deleted, and you can always follow and figure out what exactly happened. That's important. It will speed things up inside the enterprise and inside the agencies, especially when they react to bad events when they do happen. And that's crucial going forward.
You know, Michael, I live in a small town in Virginia, really tiny town, 4 stoplights, 4 breweries. 1 block from my house is a library, mm-hmm. and I've never been in it. I walk by it a lot, and I think it's very nice. I think if I had young kids, I'd be there a lot. But when talks a lot, when people think about libraries and virtual security, whole different world. So what kind of libraries do you handle?
Yeah, so libraries for a software developer are a thing that you can take intact and extend the functionality of your own code and your own product. And so, you know, you define an interface to that so that people know what they need to tell you and they know what results you'll give back to them. And so, you know, we call them software building blocks because people don't necessarily even know what software libraries are sometimes when they're starting off. But, you know, so our version of a library is not a repository of all data. It is a thing that actually allows you to protect all your data.
Through public key infrastructure, is that the?
It is through public key infrastructure. One of the things that we say, since we're trying to move to developers who don't know things about cryptography, is when we say things like PKI, that we've screwed up, and that, you know, they shouldn't have to know that. They should just have to know, here's a call you make that it can encrypt your data, that can decrypt your data, that can verify the authenticity of the data.
Dimitri, I went to your website, virgilsecurity.com. And I saw hashtag secure the future, no more passwords, encrypt everything, make encryption easy. Is this a response to the insider threat? Is that what's motivating a lot of this?
Certainly in the federal space. But even prior to that, you were having encryption deployed at scale in a way that you previously haven't seen before. Certainly in the explosion of Bitcoin and the blockchains, this is circa 2010. This is one of the largest PKI systems in the world, and yet most people don't even realize that's what it is. So you're seeing financial firms using cryptography in interesting ways and going forward in more ways, and our entire financial system is built on PKI, and that's a good thing. This is why you're seeing financial firms probably not suffering those catastrophic attacks that we've seen. Certainly some agencies have suffered over the last couple of years.
Interesting. Michael, if I talk about a company called IBM, I don't want to put you to sleep, but they did a study and they talked about cybersecurity. And they said that insider threats are 60% of all intrusions. And what's interesting is they're mostly discovered after they happen. It's like the door's gone and the horse is out and the door's gone. So insider threat again, isn't it?
It is. And I think what's even more scary about that particular statistic is they're usually discovered more than a year after they take place.
1 year.
So that is definitely bad. Insider threat, it in many ways gets back to those breaches, because, like, you know, if you've got passwords and you can get people to surrender those passwords and they don't know that they've done that, then that actually becomes an insider threat in and of itself. They're not even acting consciously against you, but, you know, their failure to abide by some security posture has opened that door to the attack.
So, Dimitri, I read Epstein's book on Edward Snowden, motivated by you two. And it looks like he had a lot of passwords. And it looks like he had some friends who had a lot of passwords. Someone had a lot of something. And so even if stuff was encrypted, he had access to it. So how does cryptography work with insiders who know the passwords?
Look, I think the problems are twofold. Inside the enterprise, we've always treated the network as trusted. And we've always treated people like Snowden as trusted people. And that in and of itself was a policy problem. You As we go forward, well-protected enterprises will treat all networks as inherently insecure, all storage is inherently insecure, and all people as potentially vulnerable. As we go into that brave new world, things like firewalls and VPNs are probably a lot less important. End-to-end encryption is a lot more important. Verifying every step of the way and authenticating every step is a lot more important. Things like machine learning would have caught what he was doing easily if we actually had them deployed. Generally, this is just the overall structure of the network has to change. Previously, we were building a moat around a certain network, and we were saying everything inside is secure. Everyone who is inside that network is fundamentally also secured. We have to change that thinking. We have to understand that that's no longer the case. As soon as we do that, insider threat will start being a lot less complicated to solve going forward.
Let's take a little break, come back, talk more about cryptography and what it means for my federal listeners. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. In the studio, Michael Wellman, Dimitri Dane, with a company called Virgil Security. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. In the studio, Michael Wellman and Dimitri Dane, D-A-I-N, and they're both founders of a company called Virgil, V-I-R-G-I-L, Virgil Security, virgilsecurity.com. We're talking about cryptography and some of the successes they've had in the commercial world and maybe how my federal listeners can maybe listen to this interview and maybe get some insight and find out, you know, how maybe they can apply it for their particular situation, how they can't, and where cryptography fits in their whole background here. We've been talking about insider threat. In the break, we're talking about a funny, funny word. I'm so old, I can remember a TV show with Johnny Carson called Who Do You Trust? It was back years and years ago. But that's the question everyone's asking today, too. It's, I got this network. Who do I trust Michael? I mean, if you assume that the walls are down and the enemy is within, that's where the who you trust question. Now, Dimitri, you're way too young for that show, aren't you?
Yes.
But who do you trust, Dimitri? Someone in the network, outside the network, encrypted? You trust encrypted data? Who do you trust?
Look, who do you trust becomes part of the business process, and it becomes part of not trusting too much or too many people. Previously, you know, obviously we trusted too many people and too much data was accessible to us. At the same time, you know, without any authentication, validation, without us actually having any audit logs that were actually being looked at constantly. So who do you trust who do you need to trust is probably the right answer, especially for our listeners here. In the commercial world, obviously you have relationships with vendors and you have NDAs, and suddenly you have to build out this electronic infrastructure of who has access to my data, at what time and then under what conditions. And a lot of that is cryptography going forward. It certainly is. And this is something we solve for developers. How do you build out applications internal to the enterprise that allow you to not just trust because you clicked a button, but to mathematically prove that, hey, this is really that person accessing this data, and I understand when they accessed the data, how many times, so I can actually maintain a good handle of where my data goes and at what time. That's crucial to controlling data security versus just network security.
Michael, I alluded to how old I am, and I've been old enough to work with people in HR, and many times in HR, they would get this little resume, and it would be Michael Wellman, PhD, Harvard, and international tap dancing, and they would look at the resume and believe it. Now, what's happening is people are getting resumes, and they're saying, okay, and they try to verify. It's almost, it's this instead of assuming the positive, you almost have to assume the negative, don't you? I mean, it's the world's shifting.
Well, it's shifting, but it's not shifting because, ironically, one of the things we talk about internally goes back to Reagan and trust but verify.
That's the old phrase.
So, you know, you could assume that everything you see and told is correct and valid. But, you know, our argument is that it's much better if, you know, you have the ability to cryptographically prove that, you know, that's valid data from a valid entity. And, you know, as Dimitri alluded to, sent to you at a valid time from a valid location. And, you know, by giving people tools that make that easy to do, we allow everyone to build that into essentially everything. And, you know, trust becomes much less of a concern.
I want to talk more about trust and end users. If you read security studies, and I read them all the time, Information Week says that 95% of organizations have employees seeking to bypass security controls. That's got to be true in the federal government, got to be controlled outside the federal government. And so are there people who bypass this encryption and go, I don't need to encrypt it? Or, I mean, there's got to be something built in to force them to encrypt documents, I would think.
Yeah, that's why they should have the knobs to control that. It should be built into the app itself. It shouldn't be part of the network. It shouldn't be part of something that sits. It should be part of the application you use on a daily basis. So that's the spot where we believe the security is deployed in the most sensical way, where it is controlled in a way that not even necessarily sysadmins have access to turn something like that off. It's part of the application that you're using. It's part of your daily life, yet you shouldn't know anything about it. And that's fundamental. So building it in on the application layer is crucial. And this is what we want to give the ability people to do.
Michael, 2 years ago, I bought a Microsoft Surface Pro. It's a great little machine. It's a tank. And when I send email, it works fine. And when I do my little spreadsheets, it's fine. But recently, I've been editing video, and it just is like I want to throw it out the window. I'm suicidal. It's just too slow. And when I think of encryption and your hashtag encrypt everything, I think of a four-letter word, slow. And is that the case with this encrypt everything, John? Yeah, and after lunch, it delays everything, doesn't it?
So the short answer is not really. And I'm going to give you a much longer answer just for fun. So I've been doing, connected devices for 30 some odd years, and at every step of the way, we've always had to go back and add better security to them. Sometimes that was better authentication. Sometimes that was better accounting and auditing. And oftentimes that was encryption. So even when we worked on Wi-Fi, we ended up having to add wired equivalency privacy, which was a horrible form of encryption, but it was a form of encryption. At the time, in 1998, 1999, the CPUs were slow enough that there was an impact by turning on encryption. At this point in time, we're working with customers who are building light bulbs that are smart light bulbs that are remotely controlled, and they have sensors in them to push data to the cloud for analytics. And those light bulbs have 30-cent components in them to be the CPU that runs the light bulb that has built-in cryptographic primitives that have no impact on the speed and the throughput of the system. So 15, 20 years ago, there was a definite impact when you encrypted everything. But at this point in time, for most devices, there's not a noticeable impact in performance.
Interesting. Dimitri, do you agree? Here, we'll fight in the studio here.
No, I actually agree. And just wanted to point out, Intel, who is a partner of ours in deploying Intel SGX, certainly has done a lot in silicon to enable really fast encryption and deployment of good application security going forward. Maybe it's not in the latest generation of chips, but generally going forward, most chips you're buying, most silicon you're buying, both general purpose and as you're buying some mobile chips as well, they have crypto primitives built in. This should not have any impact on user experience whatsoever if you're doing it right. If you're not doing it right, the impact is always there. Certainly that is a consideration. Latency is a consideration for some time-critical real-time applications, whether you do have enough speed to enable real-time encryption. But generally, for most use cases, the vast majority of use cases, they should be using cryptography regardless, and they have everything they need in silicon.
Michael, over Memorial Day, my wife and I went up to Ohio and came back, and I drove through Pittsburgh. And I think of Pittsburgh, I think of Carnegie Mellon CERT. And I don't know if they're there or not, but that's what I think of CERT. And what CERT says is that some insider threats are intentional and some are unintentional. Oh, little Mikey, he sent out this encrypted file and it wasn't encrypted and it wasn't intentional, but it happened nonetheless. So how do you prevent that?
That gets back to being multi-factor authentication as opposed to just single-factor authentication and passwords. So, one of the things we've mentioned in passing up to this point is where you have true deep security, they're doing things to the point of, you have to have a device on your person. You have to provide information that you know to that device. The device has to be at your desk or in the vicinity of your office, and it has to be during work hours that you should be there, and it should be data that you're normally accessing. So all of these tools exist to ensure that you can limit access to data very tightly. Now, The trick to all of that is you want to make that as transparent as possible to ensure that the security doesn't get in the way of doing your job. So you do have to make a few decisions on how secure do I want to make this and how difficult and how often do I want them to authenticate. But, you know, those become policy and business decisions, not security decisions.
So, Dimitri, when your website says no more passwords, does that mean multi-factor authentication? Is that what
Absolutely.
It means?
Absolutely, yeah. And using a public-private key infrastructure as authentication at every step. So previously, we generally, once you allowed in, you allowed in. And you see that all the time. Your session timeout may be 30 minutes, maybe 30 days. We want to be able to give developers ability to authenticate every time you click a link, every time you open a file, every single time you do something on the network that causes you to access information or to save information. And we want to save that information as well, cryptographically protecting it in the meantime. So there are many steps to this, to getting rid of the passwords, but in short, it's given people the ability to authenticate nearly constantly versus authenticate only once in a while and going away.
And as often as not without manual intervention on that authentication.
Yeah, yeah. It would all be tied to your device that you have.
Let's take a break. When we come back, talk more about multi-factor authentication, cryptography, and what it means for my listeners. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, Michael Wellman, Dimitri Dane, and they are both founders of a company called Virgil Security. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, we have Michael Wellman and Dimitri Dane. They're both founders of a company called Virgil, V-I-R-G-I-L, Virgil Security. Finally, a radio-friendly name. It's hard to find. We've been talking about cryptography and in the break, we're talking about different topics, and one topic that popped up was the cloud. Well, you know, I had Vivek Kundra sit in there 8 years ago and pound on the table and go move to the cloud, 25 points. I've had so many people coming in and go and talk about cloud and cloud. So does your product work with the cloud, Michael? What's this cloud got to do with cryptography anyway?
So short version is yes. The longer version, because I always love the longer version, is since we were sitting out to build a cryptographic layer for what we refer to as the entirety of the internet, we knew that we had to build something that functioned not just on the desktop, but also on mobile devices like Android and iOS, and on Linux devices like CentOS and Red Hat. And that takes us from there to the cloud. So, you know, I mentioned that we had a client that's making smart light bulbs. You know, when we look at their use case, they configure the light bulbs with either a web browser or a mobile device. So our software is running in both of those instances. And that pushes data to the sensors that are in the light bulb and the light bulb. There are actually two instances of our software running there, and that pushes data back to the cloud for analytics, where they do things like build heat maps for their customers and traffic patterns. And so to give them a single solution that works everywhere is important, and the cloud is clearly an important part of that.
So Dimitri, this is open source, is that right?
Yeah, everything is open source. And we really don't believe in any security product that isn't open source. If it's not open source, it's not secure. It's a fundamental rule. You have to be independently able to verify. And this is just actually what we do in cryptography all the time. You have to be independently able to verify the provenance of where the data came from. Same thing with the software. If it's not open source, it's very hard to maintain security of the closed source system.
So there's open data and there's open source. Maybe you want to maybe go a little bit more detail with open source. Some listeners know about it, some don't. So all that means is that there's a piece of code that's up there. People can test it, see if it in fact works or not, and verify it, because that's what people are going to be doing. They're going to say, hey, I'm going after Dimitri's new code. Maybe he screwed up. And if it's almost like the scientific method, is where 10 different people test it and they go, oh, okay, Michael, 2 and 2 is 4. Okay. And they're reluctant, but they agree with it. So that's what open source is all about. It's almost a scientific approach to testing code.
Yeah, absolutely. It allows people to independently compile it with the compilers of their own choice that they actually trust. And that's important in security, because one of the more famous long-term hacks we've had is when the compiler itself was fundamentally changed to insert a bug into the program. So people having to trust us for a binary distribution or having to trust another vendor, whether it's binary or a piece of hardware, is a lot of times not a good idea. Having them look at the code, take the code and compile it with something they actually trust that they have validated and allows them to run on the hardware that they have in-house, it's fundamental to security. If you're not doing this, it's very hard for you to say that you're actually secure.
So, Michael, when it comes to open source what you're doing is you're saying we've got a better mousetrap and take a test drive, see if it's a better mousetrap at all. I mean, you're almost asking your community to validate some innovations that you have.
In a lot of ways, we are. So as Dimitri said, you need to verify the code itself. But the other thing that you get with open source is, if the vendor goes away, you have the source. You can rebuild your product at any point in time. So you have the security, not just of secure code, but knowing you have access to that code for your product in its lifetime. So when we're building Internet of Things devices, some of those are going to live 20 to 50 years. You can't afford to bet that your vendor is going to be here in 5 or 10 years. If we look at some companies I won't name, they shut down projects every 6 months. The other part of the open source is, you can use our code without using any of our paid commercial services, and that will give you a substantial portion of the cryptographic functionality. But when you want to get to the higher level services, then you can start to use our key management in the cloud with that open source. So that for us, that becomes a viral infector, where if you want to add symmetric cryptography to your product in minutes, you can do that, use our open source product and never have to pay us a dime. But then when you want to move to asymmetric cryptography or public-private key cryptography, all you have to do is change a few parameters and you get those extra features and you pay us a few pennies per identity per month.
Earlier, Michael talked about light bulbs and IoT. Now, Dimitri, I have a friend who owns a company and they deal with aviation maintenance, aerospace maintenance. And there's a lot of sensors involved in aerospace maintenance now. And if you combine that with big data, companies like Oracle will pound on the table and go, well, hey, look at here. We can look at that plane and we can predict when that component's going to fail. And are people getting so enamored of the ability of predictive analytics to forget to encrypt the IoT sensors? Or what breakthroughs are in through in like important systems like aerospace systems?
Well, looking at the crystal ball, I think every sensor is going to have cryptography built into it. It is going to actually cryptographically sign everything that it produces. So if it was a temperature, if it's a cycle timer, it will actually produce the timer data and it sign it, it will say. And then not only that, we will actually going to be storing it in the blockchain style systems, not necessarily in the cryptocurrencies, but in the private blockchains. Where you will be able to go back and historically look at that data and know that it hasn't been changed, it cannot be changed. This is something that a lot of the breaches kind of omit. It's not just about the release of information. It's also about, has the attacker changed any of the information? And when we're talking about something as crucial as an airplane sensor, you certainly are not going to be in position if you're not mathematically proving that that sensor was producing the right data through the history of that sensor, how can you trust it? So that's sort of systems are coming online, and you're going to see most sensors now having that functionality built in. It's going to be up to the application developer to take advantage of them and deploy them properly.
So, Michael, when people think about cars, they think about sensors. So is encryption going to have to be, your 2015 Subaru, we're going to have to bolt on encryption to the sensors? Or it seems like a headache. I mean, if it's not built in, I don't know how you can build it on.
So that is a fun question. and cars are a particularly problematic case because by the design of the network inside the cars, they're designed to not have cryptography, to not have authentication. So it becomes a situation where the things that you add to that system reflect what we were talking about earlier, where you just have to assume that the network and transport layer you're using are fundamentally insecure. But when you build a product that goes onto that system, if you make the product and its interactions with itself secure, and if you take that system on the car and it goes to the internet to update its firmware, and you make that secure, the insecurity of the system stops being a problem. Deploying things that are insecure and having to support them for 10 and 15 years is going to be a nightmare for some companies, and it's going to end up having to throw a lot of things away. So that's why it's critical for IoT people in particular now that this trend is just starting, that they, focus on getting security into their first products and their first generations as soon as possible.
So, Dimitri, it seems to me that if you're listening to this show and you're involved in project management, just about anything, because everything from aerospace to healthcare IT, look at the healthcare IT, to regular quotidian devices like cameras and mice, You almost have to go to Virgin Security and just see what's going on, get an idea of what's going on out there before you jump in the water and find out what the temperature is, because you may, oh, I should have done X, Y, or Z. VirginSecurity.com, probably a good place to start, I would think.
It's certainly one of the places, but generally looking at the industry practices going forward is a good idea. We certainly had a lot of new information posted about how to secure IoT, both from NIST and certainly a lot is coming out of Europe and to a certain extent out of China as well. Everybody is interested to make sure that IoT happens. And it happens at scale. It's the only way for a lot of people to make money if it happens at scale. And it doesn't happen at scale if there are security concerns. So not enough people are going to buy it. Not enough products are going to use it. So it's important to kind of take a look at what everyone's doing, depending on your industry. Or certainly if you're in cars, a lot of the standards are driven actually by the Europeans in airspace as well. NIST is just published IoT guidance. But look at the most secure products out there. Look at what Apple is doing with their ecosystem. Everything is cryptographically protected, the entire ecosystem, all the way from the silicon. Does your chip have a secure enclave? Do you have a way to store securely private keys? Those are some of the questions you can ask, and a lot of people are going to have bad answers to them.
So, Michael, I got a 20-second question. I want to give an answer. So the best cryptographers in the world are living in which country?
Oh, that's just me. Well, since most of my cryptographic team is in Ukraine, I'm going to say Ukraine.
Not Israel. Well, we'll have to have a battle of the bands or something and find out down the road.
I would counter that most Israeli crypto guys speak Russian.
Ah, isn't that interesting? Yeah. Now, there's a provenance question of who comes from where. And interesting question. Let's have to end the interview here. We're running out of time. You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, we had Michael Wellman and Dimitri Dane. They're both founders of a company called Virgil Security.
You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of Lectromech, providing solutions to design, certify, and maintain aircraft wire systems. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal Tech Talk only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.